Today's program was brought to you by Carp Resources, carpresources.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Zorn, the food editor at Northside Media, which produces the annual Taste Talks Festival in both Brooklyn and Chicago. And FYI, early bird tickets just happen to be on sale now. Picking up where the festival left off, the Taste Talks podcast brings innovators from various fields, including music, art, media, design, and tech, together with luminaries from the food and restaurant world to expound on any and all topics related to taste. During today's show, I'll be joined by two undeniable industry heavyweights, cookbook author, celebrity chef, and top restaurant owner Mark Murphy, as well as tech guru Craig Kanarek, CEO of the leading online indie food marketplace Mouth, to talk about building a brand, their fun new collaboration, and the sheer importance of seasoning. We'll also be spotlighting some of our favorite go-to condiments at the end of the half hour, and we are not talking about Heinz or Hellman's. But first, I'll be joined in the studio by Matt Bruck, the founder of Joyous, to chat about the week's breaking national food news. Hi there, Matt.
Hi.
Thank you for coming back.
A pleasure.
So, at Northside, you know, we've always got our eyes on music and food in equal measure, which is why we were all about that story a few weeks ago regarding Morrissey's demand that Madison Square Garden go entirely vegan for his June 27th concert. But he is certainly not the only famous musician with an active interest in food policy. I think you know who I'm talking about. It was recently announced that the always outspoken Neil Young, founder of Farm Aid, as most of you know, is releasing a new album on June 29th called The Monsanto Years, featuring 9 tracks, each of which basically gives a giant middle finger to the much reviled agrochemical giant, as well as his longtime nemesis Starbucks,
right,
which he takes aim at in the song A Rock Star Bucks a Coffee Shop. So, Matt, are you a Neil Young fan, and do you have any additional details on his upcoming Eco LP?
Yes, a fan. Sort of. Not after the last
qualifying
record. That last record with the American Idol producer and an orchestra was not the Neil Young that I want to listen to. I would like to listen to Crazy Horse. I didn't like the last record. I saw the video. It's him flinging Starbucks cups. It's a little silly.
Well, can you explain, you know, why he has this whole contretemps going with Starbucks, yes?
There is a question about whether he's misguided. So Starbucks was allegedly teaming with Monsanto to fight some Vermont legislation about labeling. Starbucks has said they weren't involved, and the state of Vermont has said they were not involved. But Neil Young has insisted they're involved. I can't tell you what the true story is, but the state of Vermont says, no, they're not involved.
Well, essentially, this album is coming out soon. He is going on tour to back the album. You could get tickets for now. You know what? If you're going to go out, you know, and buy an expensive concert for the summer season, I would do that. I could bet there will be no GMO concessions at the Neil Young show. That's for sure.
He has said that.
But no chips.
No, I think you're right. But he's also, remember, his band is Willie Nelson's two sons.
Yes.
And so there's always the possibility that Willie Nelson will pop up and we'll have some kind of fun thing happen there. That's what I'm hoping for.
Because we needed more firepower
at the anti-Monsanto
concert.
Absolutely.
I wonder if he's going to be like Morrissey, who famously employs bouncers to make sure that people don't come into his concert with meat. So maybe he'll have bodyguards to make sure nobody's sneaking in any corn-fed beef into his concert this summer.
I'm hoping that's the case. I'm also hoping that he will play on an old Neil Young classic and sing something about, "Look out, Mama, there's a flat white coming up the river." Okay,
well,
enough. Go ahead.
Anyway, another newsy tidbit. It's not quite as inspiring as the Neil Young story. It doesn't necessarily give itself to as many delightful word puns, but it's equally music related. I don't know if you heard about this one, but the head brewer at Dock Street in Philadelphia has decided to expose one of his latest creations to a 24/7 Wu-Tang Clan playlist for the next 6 months. So besides being a gimmick, I mean, he says that, you know, the thumping bass tracks from the music will kind of disrupt the beer and aid in during the fermentation process, create new and interesting flavors. It sounds gimmicky, but is there any precedent for using music to actively brew beer, as far as you know?
I am not able to answer that question, but I will say it's a legit brewery. It's been there for a long time. They make really good beer. If they're doing a marketing gimmick, great. I'm also going to say that this is important. Wu-Tang has promoted beer. I don't know if you remember that they did St. Ives commercials in the 90s. There was a Snoop one. There was a Wu-Tang one.
You're aging yourself.
I am not going to deny that I remember them.
Aging yourself in Roberta's.
These were fantastic commercials. But I'm going to say more important than this. It's time for, I think it's Flagship, the brewery that's right by the Staten Island Ferry, to say, we take the challenge on. We are going to produce a Shaolin beer. And if we have to, we're going to reach down for a Philadelphia band to come in and do live performance. I think Flagship and a Roots collaboration, some kind of Shaolin brew has to happen to take this on and say Staten Island claims its place as the beer center of New York hip hop drinking.
I can't wait. I also can't wait for this beer, which should be showing up to a bar near you. It's called Ain't Nothing to Funk With. It has notes of pineapple and orange, supposedly, and whatever else the Wu-Tang Clan playlist adds to the flavor profile. Anyway, you are listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network, and we will be right back.
And the break song here is called Vicodin Dreams by Techstar. We'll be right back.
CARP Resources is proud to be a member of the business community that supports Heritage Radio Network. CARP Resources solves food problems. Our mantra is good food is good business, and it's our mission to help you connect the two. From designing regional sourcing strategies and sustainability plans to developing cutting-edge food curricula, we customize your approach to changing the food environment in your communities, marketplaces, or within your own organizations. Our diverse team of thinkers and practitioners apply honed methodologies and tactical experience to each challenge and opportunity. Our unparalleled cross-sector network expands your own, whether you are a philanthropic organization, a community college, a global food distributor, or a children's museum. To learn more, please visit carpresources.com.
Well, my next two guests certainly ain't nothing to funk with. In fact, they are both so accomplished. I'm having a bit of one of these things is not like the other moment. To touch on only a few high points from both of their resumes, Mark Murphy is the chef owner of top New York restaurants Landmark, Kingside, and Ditch Plains, a frequent judge on Food Network's Chopped, amongst other shows, the author of the recently published cookbook Season with Authority, and winner of the Sexiest Chef Alive title in People's Sexiest Men Alive issue, which I'm sure he would count as his greatest career triumph. Craig Kanarik is an accomplished thought leader, executive, entrepreneur, digital technology expert, and candy artist with a career that's been characterized by integrating technology, design, and brand strategy in order to grow businesses through innovation. He co-founded the pioneering internet services firm Razorfish in 1995, which was at the forefront of the internet era, and is currently the CEO of New York Mouth, the leading online indie food marketplace. Hello, gentlemen. That's our show for today after reading your resumes. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
So besides being friends and having a collaboration on Mouth, which we will absolutely get to, you both have a lot of insight on what it takes to build a successful brand. Mark, you're essentially a brand for all intents and purposes, with restaurants and books and products, a career on television, and Craig, you've helped grow brands for over 20 years, from startups to Fortune 100 companies. So to start with, Mark, can you talk a bit about how your career has evolved from being a faceless restaurant chef to being a globally recognized personality?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here today. It's very exciting. I've never been here before. And
Murphy's radio cherry. I love it.
I started cooking obviously years ago. I had no idea the direction it was going to take. I thought my main goal was to eat because I didn't want to be hungry. I thought if I learn how to cook, I will be able to eat. And when I started cooking a couple of years ago, now that I'm older, maybe a little over 20 years ago, There wasn't all these other things going on. There wasn't, you know, the Food Network's only 20 years old. I thought my destiny was to be behind a stove my whole life, which I was perfectly happy doing. And how it all came about, well, it's a long story and a long journey. And it was interesting because I had never really thought about it because I always think about tomorrow and not yesterday. And writing a cookbook really makes you sit down and think about where it all started. And it took about a year, and it was sort of like a long therapy session, really writing the foreword of the cookbook and my whole story. But it's been, I think, you know, the one thing people ask me a lot is, what's the most important thing? And I think the most important thing in whatever you do is you just got to have fun doing it. And if you have fun doing it, it's everything else is going to come to you. It's the money, the fame, or whatever you want it to have happen. You just have to have fun. And if you follow that path, I think that was my goal.
Well, do you think that, you know, fun and even talent is enough? Because it feels like, forget about television, but even if a chef wants to have a cookbook published nowadays, you need to have a little bit of notoriety. So how do these young chefs, not even young chefs, but under the radar chefs, get their name out there in a way that will take them to the next level?
I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to get your name out there. I mean, I guess you could go get arrested. That'll get your name out there really quickly, right? No, maybe not the best way to go. I mean, for me, it's what, as I said, enjoying myself and just hard work and really loving what you do is that's the foundation. The rest of it is, you know, you got to get yourself known by meeting the right people, by impressing the right people, I guess. But all, as I said, all that comes along with you if you're enjoying and doing what we really like. And I think being a hard worker is definitely something that's very, very important. I think a lot of people want all this notoriety and want all this stuff, but they don't want to put the work behind it. And that is a big problem. And it's interesting when you see kids that are coming up these days and they want to have all this notoriety, and you get these people that start working for you and they want your job right away. It's like, wait, no, I did this for years. I worked stations in restaurants for many, many years before I got to where I am. And you got to put the time in. You have to have very good peripheral vision, I always say. You have to be able to look at everything going on around you, because as a line cook, which is what we all, as a chef, we all were line cooks at one point, you have to be able to do 10 or 20 things at the same time. Like, you know, watching the vegetables here and the Chateaubriand in the oven, you're cooking a duck over here, you got something else in the salamander. And running a business is the same thing. You have to learn and you have to keep your eye on the ball at the same time everywhere. And it's, I think being a cook is very good training for the rest of your life, really, for anything, any job.
Sure. Well, Craig, just like it takes a little more than talent to become a chef brand, it takes, I would imagine, a lot more than having a good product to be a successful product. So what do you look for when it comes to the brands that you decide to showcase, the indie brands that you showcase on your food site, Mouth?
Well, you know, Our curation strategy is relatively simple. And the first thing is that the products have to taste great. They just have to be, you know, incredible products. But I think what's happening in the world of let's say food products or product brands in general is that, you know, we now have an enormous amount of choice. We have access to products from all around the world at the touch of a finger with the computer. So we can stay home and shop at every store in the world. I can buy probably, you know, 4,000 different types of candy bars from my living room. So, you know, when a consumer has the ability to buy any of those things, they need to, you know, choose carefully. And the brands that stand out are the ones that have good stories behind them. I think people these days, you know, some people will pick a brand because they've never heard of it. That has some appeal. Just, it's new. I want to try the new thing. But I think what's happening is that, in particular around food, the story behind either the person making it, where the ingredients came from, what the technique was to make it, that becomes as much as part of the flavor and the taste of the product as anything else does. And so that, you know, helps inform the stuff that we choose for the store.
Well, I'm definitely interested to learn a bit more about how you yourself got to Mouth, because your career has been so interesting and so diverse. In addition to your achievements in the technology and corporate sectors, you were a prep cook intern at Babbo. You create and photograph artworks made entirely of candy. So talk about how you started out working for monster brands like Coca-Cola and turned your attention to indie brands?
Well, you know, I think, 20 years ago when I started a digital consulting company, we just tried to help any brands adjust to the digital, now the digital past, but what was the digital future? And we got very lucky that we had some connections in different companies and were able to be at the right place at the right time. And you know, when you, when you're a consulting company and you get a couple of big name clients, then a lot of the other big companies come along, because big companies don't like to take risks. So they figure, well, if that other guy, you know, if they work for that company, then sure, they're good enough for me. So, you know, we were lucky at Razorfish to have a couple of big clients early on, and that helped, you know, what we were doing. You know, it's funny. My internship at Baba was similar to what you were saying. I just wanted to learn how to cook. I did that. I was actually going to try to go to cooking school, and Mario said, come work for me for free. And I thought that sounded like a great idea. It certainly worked out well for him.
Right.
Some free labor. So, I went there just to
I hope learn. You supply him with products.
You know, he gets a good deal. So I ended up interning there for about 9 months. And then when they offered me a full-time position on the line, I decided to give notice, because I thought if I was good enough to be on the line, I was good enough to throw good dinner parties, which was like my entire reason for ending up at the restaurant, was just to sort of learn how to cook for myself and to throw good parties. Right.
It's cheaper than going to cooking school, that's for sure.
It was much cheaper, yeah.
Right.
And I think some people would probably argue more practical.
And a lot more fun.
Yeah.
I find fewer and fewer chefs, even if they, or maybe especially if they went that route, are advocating cooking school for chefs that want to start out today, because you, just like really any other degree, you end up with just a tremendous amount of debt and not a lot of, you know, skill that you could use in the real world. Would you, since you're on that subject, would you?
I always tell people, listen, you want to go to cooking school. It's a lot of money. I said, the first thing you need to do is go find a local chef, one or two restaurants. You got to just, even if it's just to go stand in the corner and watch what happens at a dinner service and see what people do. You have to first enjoy the environment. I think some people that walk into a professional kitchen walk out and say, these people are complete lunatics. I don't know how they get up every morning and do this. Most of the time, 6 days a week. And it, you have to be ready to sacrifice going out to dinner with friends, because you're probably going to work dinner shifts for 6 days a week for 2 or 3 years straight in one restaurant. And you know what? By that time, all your friends have given up on you. They don't want to have dinner with you because you're tired that one night that you're off, and the last thing you want to do is go out. So it's a dedication, and it's a sacrifice. I mean, you're not, you know, your friends are going to go to a movie. They're going to go out and do something, and you can't do that. You're working when everybody else is actually relaxing or being entertained.
Well, Craig, I'm assuming the time with Mario taught you maybe that you were not meant for a career as a chef, but that you wanted to continue a life that was in some way related to food.
Yeah, and it solidified my relationship with food, but being a line cook and working my way up to being a chef was not the path for me. Mostly because I thought the people were nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and that the lifestyle was nuts. And that was part of it, too, is that after doing that for 9 months, the idea that I was then making a commitment to that schedule for the next few years, I thought was not something that I could do. But, you know, you talk about the difference between having practical experience and sort of educational experience. It's really hard, I think, to sort of say, well, you shouldn't go to school. Instead, you should go get a job, whether it's in any profession. You know, I think there's value in both of those things. Either way, you're going to have to put in hard work, right? So there's certainly I got a very deep education working at that restaurant in one particular cuisine and one particular type of cooking. And, you know, had I gone to cooking school, I would have had a much more survey experience, would have learned a bunch of things that I didn't learn there. So it's not as simple as like skip school because it's expensive and just go get a job. It's not necessarily a road to success.
Well, yeah, that's why I say figure out if you like it first, then go spend the money and then go to work.
So, Craig, do you advise any of the brands that are part of your site on any level? Do they get the benefit of your incredible expertise, or is it more about creating a highly curated forum where the products can be discovered and seen?
No, you know, part of our mission is to help these startup companies, and many of them are startups, but these independent food producers grow their business. And you know, one way we do that, of course, is buying their product and then providing it to other people and having a platform for people to discover it. But, you know, what we're trying to do is go back to these people and take some of the expertise that we have now as a retailer that maybe they don't have as a manufacturer. And whether that's around ways they can improve their packaging or new places to source materials or to source product or different ways to market their product. So there's a lot of, after now 3-4 years of doing this, a lot of expertise about the industry that we have and just connections and information that we have that maybe some of these smaller companies don't have access to.
So, Mark, I guess when it comes to fostering young talent, I would definitely say that culinary competition shows like Chopped could absolutely serve as an incubator for young talent, provided, of course, that they shine as opposed to crash and burn, which is always a danger. So what do you think it takes to be successful on shows like that? And would you advise under-the-radar chefs to use reality food, TV, or culinary competition shows as a tool, as a way of getting their names and faces out there, even if there's like a danger of them not being presented in the best light?
I think that when people come on the shop, I think there is an ability to get your name out there. But it's, I think sometimes people think it's going to be a lot bigger splash than it is. I mean, it's, if you think about it, we've shot over 300 and I think 30 shows. So that times four people, that's a lot of people. So you're going to get a little bit of something, which will be great. And if you come off in a certain way, maybe somebody will be excited about picking you up and doing other stuff. For me, it's really a game show in a certain sense. I mean, some people that are really, really great chefs crash and burn on Chopped. It's a game show. I mean, what in no realistic terms does any of us in our industry as a cook or a chef or a sous chef ever have to make a dish with three crazy ingredients in 20 minutes and actually feed people? It's a game. I mean, it's not something that's, and it's weird because some people have that muscle. They can do that in that certain scenario. And some people open up that thing and they're just like, I don't know. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, how are you going to do anything with this? I mean, I have never made a special that I've run in my restaurants that has taken me 20 minutes to put together and put out. I mean, it would be silly. So I guess it's a yes and a no answer. I mean, you get your name out there. If you win Chopped, I've traveled around the country and I see the menus will say the chef here is the Chopped champion, you know, and it's great. I think the whole thing is fantastic just because it's getting the word out about food. I think it's educating viewers about food, about techniques, about what to do with certain ingredients. There's ingredients that I go on there sometimes. I'm like, the heck is this stuff? You know, I mean, they source stuff from everywhere. They're the people that are the food producers on Chopped are amazing. I don't know how they're still coming up with food and different basket combinations. It's pretty wild, but it's something that, you know, you have to, you know, you just gotta, it's fun. And, you know, if you want to go on the show, as I always tell people, there's only one person that's going to win. There's a good chance you're not going to make it to the end.
So you've actually said that you've described working at your restaurants as kind of working inside of a box. So you may or may not agree that being a successful chef brand can kind of become a double-edged sword because your two landmark locations share an established identity. Ditch Plains is your beachy, you know, surfer fish shack. It has a very fixed concept. So how do you stay innovative and attract new audiences once you've begun working inside that very identifiable box?
I think that, I mean, for me, my background, I mean, I was born in Italy. My mother's French. I'm half French. I grew up mostly in Europe. So my culinary world is basically America, France, and Italy. I'm not going to open a sushi restaurant, that's for sure. But I think that for me to be able to stay, my brands, yes, Landmark is a brand. It's a neighborhood bistro with some Italian influences. As I tell my chefs and my sous chefs that work with me there, it's like when we're going to do specials, you do live inside a box. You can't start doing sushi as appetizer at Landmark. People would walk in and go, what are you doing? What are you doing right here? You can't be doing that. So for me, about trying to do other brands, well, for me, I can probably go into the Mediterranean aspect. I mean, having grown up and eaten in that sort of world, I can do that. So I think that, yes, my scope is, well, limited, but not. But my limit is pretty big. If I take France, Italy, and America, is pretty good. Pretty darn good.
You got a little room to play.
I'm good. I'm not going to, as I said, I'm not going to open an Indian restaurant. I'm not going to open a Chinese restaurant. But I think that's one of the downsides of becoming a chef and having a brand and having what you have, because I do miss the time when I was a line cook and I could quit a job after a year or two after I'd felt I had learned everything and say, go work for somebody like Mario Batali or go work for another chef and just cook their food and learn. And just because as a chef or as a line cook, you're just absorbing all this information all the time. I mean, I would love it. I've often thought, well, you know, I would love to go back and I mean, I'm getting a little old now, but the stamina you need to work on a line is not the easiest thing. But going to work a station in another chef's restaurant that's completely different, like say if I went to work in an Indian restaurant and went and learned how to work the line or a station, which meaning a station, you're only working, picking up 5, maybe 10 dishes, but really learning how to do those 10 dishes the way that chef really wants them. That to me would be really intriguing and a lot of fun. And unfortunately, when you become a chef and you have as many things going on as I do, I can't do that. I would show up with my resume. They'd be like, what are you doing here?
I don't know. Anybody hiring? Anybody looking for Mark Murphy to play around in their kitchen? Well, Craig, when back in the day, when you were just a plucky young entrepreneur, you actually founded Razorfish, now a ginormous company, in your partner's Manhattan apartment all the way back in 1995. Mouse headquarters are currently in Dumbo, which makes a lot of sense, owing to Brooklyn's impressive run as a mecca for young innovators and plucky startups. But as the city at large, especially Brooklyn, becomes increasingly exclusively accessible to your former corporate clients as opposed to your current indie clients, what do you think that really means for the future of food innovation in New York?
You know, I think that the death of Brooklyn due to high prices is probably a little prematurely announced. But, I understand the fear that it's happened in Manhattan. Obviously, there are fewer and fewer sort of gritty neighborhoods and inexpensive ones. And it does happen. I think it's going to take a long time for Brooklyn to get fully saturated. And there's only so far out we can push people, right? Because at the end of the day, there needs to be, part of the reason that less wealthy neighborhoods can exist is due to public transportation and some of the other access to resources that you just can't get in the suburbs, or further out. So there's always going to be, a creative class and starving artists in every place. So I think that Brooklyn will continue, and frankly, Manhattan as well, and all of New York will continue to play an important role. The city has some dynamics to it, it is a crossroads of cultures and of peoples and of every possible thing that you can find on the planet comes through New York at some point. And so the access to all of those things is very valuable. And I think it's going to allow people to stay creative and to keep innovating here for many, many decades.
So you've seen a lot, obviously, in your time, and you've worked for some really serious brands, McDonald's and, Subway. What are some brands in your mouth stable that are really sticking out to you right now that wowed you with innovation, that showed you something that was not currently on the market?
Oh, that's a great question. Many of them are doing different types of innovation, right? So we have a sort of a category of products where people are sort of mashing together different flavors, which I'm really intrigued by. For example, we have a line of popcorn. You mentioned working in an Indian restaurant. We have a line of popcorn called Masala Pop that is taking Indian spices and applying them to popcorns. Wow. So instead of getting, cheese popcorn or just a kettle corn or something, they have three or four different flavors that are Indian spiced. We're seeing stuff in same thing happening in peanut butter, with really interesting Asian flavors being infused into different peanut butters. And so I'm finding that, those brands are doing things that are really innovative. The you talked about double-edged sword. Sometimes you can be a little too innovative and not get the audience appeal that you want to get, right? So I can talk about how much I think that Indian flavored popcorn is fantastic. There's a lot of people out there, I'm sure, who are listening or saying, I'm not
it's
interested
not
in trying
to
it. It's not going to work for me. Right.
Yeah.
That sounds like something people might try once and maybe not go for, but I think it sounds very interesting. I mean, actually, what brand have you seen that has gotten so innovative that they sort of, they were too far ahead of their times, or they crashed and burned with the too crazy an idea?
Well, some of the chocolate makers that we've had have done some pretty outrageous things. So one of our favorite products that doesn't exist anymore, a company called Hudson Chocolates. He ended up shutting down his chocolate company and taking a job, I believe. But he had a product that we love to talk about all the time. They were white chocolate covered sun-dried black olives.
Oh, That's not where I thought you were going with
that.
Yeah. So
I thought there was going to be an ant in there, or like a cricket.
No,
that would be a big seller nowadays, actually. Are you getting a lot of ant, like, you know, bug products?
You know, that's a huge protein. Yeah, cricket protein is big. And, you know, it may be in our future. I don't know in our future because we're old, but maybe, you know, in our kids' future. But it's clearly being worked with significantly. And so we're seeing it, you know, I think. That's one where those companies are really innovative and they may be huge. There's a lot of people who are not interested in trying.
Gotcha. Well, tell me about how this collaboration with Mark came to be, because you don't work exclusively with like tiny little, you know, people who wrap white chocolate around olives. Sometimes you work with Mark Murphy. So tell us a bit about the Mark Murphy Chef Kit and how that collaboration came about.
Well, we started working together, you know, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or so, when we started carrying the caramels from the restaurant. And, you know, we were really excited to be the first place to make those available to people other than going into the restaurant.
Right.
And so we'd known each other and talked about that and talked about some other projects. And just, you know, over the years, we've talked about a few different things we could do. When the cookbook came out, it seemed like a great opportunity for us to create a special package of things for people to buy on mouth. And so the kit that we're offering is an autographed copy of the cookbook, along with seasoning from the cookbook, and a t-shirt, a fantastically comfortable t-shirt, a great apron, which, you know, everybody needs. Some people overlook in the kitchen, and I've ruined way too many shirts to count, and I still don't remember to do it enough, but you know, we have the apron and we have the caramels in there as well.
The famous landmark caramels.
Yeah. And so it, you know, it's a great Father's Day gift, which is coming up in 3 weeks from yesterday, very fast.
Really?
Uh-oh, everybody out there, get on it. It's on mouth now.
So that's what we're doing, you know, and then...
We started years ago, and it was interesting. We met through a mutual friend of ours, and that's how we got to know about each other's... Well, for me, as you're saying, like a small company, basically the caramels is really the one thing that we've had on there. And that's just one product. It's not like I came on and bulldozed in with like 20 different landmark products or Mark Murphy products. It was literally, it's just a great way to get the caramels out there because people were always asking us how to get it. And I was like, for somebody like myself, New York Mouth is a great sort of, it takes the workload off of me because now they take care of shipping it and advertising it and showing it. I don't have to go and do all that myself. We do try. I mean, we sell them at the restaurant, but it's a lot easier when people tell me, oh, well, how do you get the caramels? I just send it right to New York Mouth because then people always write back and go, then there's so much other great stuff there.
Although it shouldn't preclude anybody from getting dinner at Landmark.
What he's done has been amazing in the sense that, you know, somebody comes over to your house and they did something nice for you. You know, people send you an orchid or a flower. Now all the flower people are going to be upset with me. But to me, I would so much rather send a New York Mouth bag. I mean, every time I do this, people are like, that was so great. It's all that stuff. Or somebody has a baby, like a baby, send them a New York Mouth bag because they're starving because they can't get out of the house because, of course, they just had a kid. And, you know, but it's always really cool stuff and you can curate it however you want. It's an amazing, amazing website. I love it.
Well, I'm kind of amazed that Season with Authority is your first cookbook. I can't believe we had to wait so long for a Mark Murphy cookbook. So it's all about tips for the home cook and really bringing them back to fundamentals. So why is seasoning with impunity, which I totally agree, like undersalting is an epidemic problem, but why is that at the heart of your book?
It's because every time people eat my food, whenever they're over the house, they're like, well, this is so good. I'm like, well, I didn't do anything. I just cooked it and I seasoned it correctly. That's all I really did. I'm not like a genius that it can like do abracadabra over a steak and make it taste any better than that. I didn't grow the steak. I just bought it and I seasoned it correctly and I cooked it properly. And I always tell the story of going over to this friend's house and all the kids are sitting around the table and she's got like steamed broccoli coming right out of the steamer and she's dumping it on these kids' plates. And the kids are like, and I looked at her, I said, what's wrong? What are you doing? And she goes, well, I'm feeding the kids their vegetables. And I'm like, well, they're not going to eat their vegetables if you don't put anything on them. So I took all the vegetables off the plate and I put some little olive oil, salt and pepper on it, put it back on the kids' plates. And the kids were like, my God, this is the best broccoli I've ever had. I said, you know, these cute children are not in the hospital. They don't have high blood pressure problems. It's not like they're eating steam. They don't have to eat steam food. They can eat food with flavor. And that's when I was like, you know, people just don't realize that seasoning is so important. So that's why I wanted to name it that. And I wanted people to just to get out there and cook.
I love that because I think, you know, you talked about what people learn from watching cooking shows like Chopped. And I think the one thing, you know, there's like three or four things that you hear a lot on the shows by the judges. And I think it's starting to sink into people's sort of collective cooking right. unconscious. So you talk about it needs to be, it needed more seasoning, it needed more salt. Right. You know, I think people are starting to understand the idea of acid in their food. But those are like two things that right. were not in anyone's consciousness, you know, 5 years ago.
Right. Right. Or that meat has to rest.
Right.
Like people like, what do you mean you don't know that? You know, it's like if you cut a piece of steak as soon as it comes off the grill, all that juice is going to come out on the cutting board. You're done. Your steaks, you wasted money.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people, at least a lot of home cooks, think that salt makes things salty. And so there's like a real disconnect that they don't understand that salt brings together flavors, brings them to the forefront. So they're just, there's a lot of, they're trying to self-edit and well, they're not doing anybody any favors.
I think people have been made so scared of salt. I mean, but if you think about it, you cannot survive without salt. I mean, yes, too much salt. Yes, like, you know, sitting down and having three bags of potato chips, maybe a little too much, but putting enough salt on your steak before you cook it, that's where you should be using it.
Well, moving beyond salt, I know, especially with Craig here, that you were all just bursting with great ideas that you want to showcase for amazing at-home condiments that could really bring your carefully rested steak to the next level. So we are going to take one more quick break, and we are going to come back. You are listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network.
Don't hate it, just make some noise. And this one's called No Games by Vesa. We'll be right back.
I know, it's real.
And we are back. I'm your host, Sarah Zorn, and you are listening to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio Network. So, by taking inspiration both from Mark's cookbook, Season with Authority, as well as from Mouth, which showcases and sells fantastic indie food brands, I thought we would all spotlight a few of our favorite indie condiments, the real go-tos in our home fridges and pantries. So I'm going to throw this over to my friend Matt first, although I know he hardly ever eats at home. But Matt, at the rare instance that you actually cook something for yourself, what is in your fridge? What do you find yourself dipping your spoons into?
Not true. I cook gochujang.
It's lies. It's all lies.
Gochujang is my go-to condiment at home, and I use it because when I eat at, say, Hanjeon, for example, Huni puts it all over the pork belly, and it's great. I love the chicken wings at Mukbar for that reason, and so gochujang is the thing that I use. It's important not just to smear that paste on. I dilute it with something. I use all kinds of weird things that I don't want to admit in this crowd because they'll laugh at me. But gochujang helps me out. I use tahini too. I think I keep tahini in the fridge and I use that. Those would be my two go-tos right now.
Well, guys, don't be afraid to slut out some brands. Craig, Mark, I'm throwing it over to you. What do you love besides, you know, your go-to jar of Golden's mustard?
Well, speaking of mustard, mustard is definitely high on the list. And we use, in our house, we use tin mustard made in Brooklyn for pretty much everything. In fact, my kids have been known to just eat it on a spoon, nice. Which is kind of crazy. They love that flavor. They love vinegar. So we're using a lot of tin mustard these days. We're using actually a lot of Brooklyn brands. We're using a lot of We Rub You Korean barbecue sauce.
Love it.
LVO's chimichurri.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's about a year old here, made in Brooklyn.
I've got a date with your website.
Fantastic okay. stuff. And then what I brought earlier, which has been, you know, my go-to condiment for everything from rice to eggs to pizza topping to whatever, is a bad seed chili granola, which is a mixture of everything from miso and sesame, dried apples, almonds, chili powder, and it's fantastic.
But can I suggest that they start packaging that with a side of breath mints? It was delicious, inarguably, but I've been offending myself this entire
there, yeah.
time. It's a little bit pungent. So, Mark, what do you go to when you cook at home?
Well, you know, for me, a condiment is mustard definitely for one. I use mustard all the time. I think it's great. It cuts through fat and does amazing things. And oddly enough, for me, it's capers and anchovies, really. I consider them a condiment. I think they work in so many different areas on a sandwich or just like that. I mean, they're, you know, dipping into the anchovy jar is something on a cracker is all you really need, really. I mean,
but neither is a substitute for salt. Yes. Even neither, if you throw them into your dish.
No. Well, if it's interesting because I always have a salt and pepper mix next to the stove. But when I'm doing like I'll melt some anchovies into some garlic to saute some, you know, maybe some romaine lettuce or some tomatoes. I will cut the salt back a touch because, you know, you have to compensate for the saltiness of the anchovy. But anchovies are probably one of my favorites.
Hmm. Well, I myself have got to give it up to Mike's Hot Honey, which is made by a former Pizzaiolo's at Pauly G's Pizza in Greenpoint. It's basically peppers infused into honey, and they put it on top of everything from their ice cream sundaes to their Hellboy pizza. And I've been known to just hold it up high and let it drizzle into my mouth. It's good for that as well. Mustard, too, totally. I like Fort Greene Farms. I don't know if they're one of yours, but Fort Greene Farms makes not mustard straight, but pickled mustard
beautiful,
seeds.
And they're beautiful. They're clear
so
jar. They're great.
And they burst on your tongue in a really happy way when you put them into vinaigrettes. Anything else? What other good, yummy, condimenty tidbits can you leave us with, guys?
I don't know. I'm just going on mouth and ordering all of them. That's what I'm going
to
do.
And I think
Craig
needs to start bringing you around as a walking walking advertisement. That is amazing. Anyway, guys, that is our show for today. To keep abreast of all things Mark, from info on his cookbooks to his restaurants to his television appearances, visit mark/murphy.com to truly appreciate all the many aspects and achievements of our friend Craig. Check out craigkanarek.com or visit mouth@mouth.com. You can follow Matt and all of his foodie exploits on Instagram for his amazingly beautiful food porny page at Matt Bruck, or you could follow me, not so food porny as you would think, at Sarah Zorn BK, or Taste Talks at Taste Talks. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed on iTunes or Stitcher as well. Thank you so much for tuning in, and until next time, you have been listening to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.